Parenting on Moncrief, thanks to Five Rivers Fostering, providing 24-hour support for foster parents and children. FiveRiversFostering.ie.
Joanna Fortune is here once again for our parenting slot. Good afternoon, Joanna.
Good afternoon.
Your first question is this. Our three-year-old has a speech delay and is waiting on an assessment of needs. He wasn't getting speech therapy sessions publicly, so we're lucky enough to be able to afford private speech therapy. So he's attending that. He has now also been called to speech therapy with the HSE. My query is that the two speech therapists have completely different approaches and advice. One focuses on the quality of play, and my son loves these sessions and says a lot of words to her. The other speech therapist advocates tough love and flashcards and says we should not give him anything until he says a word, even if he gets upset. The only word my son said to her was bye when he was running out the door of her session. I realise he is lucky to have access to these sessions, but I was wondering if you could give parents any guidance on how to know whether a therapist is giving suitable advice. My husband and I feel completely lost.
I don't blame you, but I think you actually have your answer in your question there.
Yeah.
The child is responding positively to the play-based approach, the more child-centred, gentler approach, and he is speaking a lot more words to that therapist within those sessions, which is the overall objective of speech and language therapy here. So I would say there's your answer. That's the best approach for your son. Honestly, the more tough love, punitive approach, I haven't come across that in years. I haven't heard of any practitioner in the paediatric field taking that approach with children. I mean, generally, I would say play is the language of children.
Yeah.
So using a play-based approach makes complete sense as a way of forming relationship, building trust, both of which are absolutely required in order for a child to engage and connect with you and integrate what you're doing. It's exactly my own approach clinically, though I'm not doing speech and language, is very, very similar. The other thing I just want to say there, though, is that if this child is attending two speech and language therapists at the same time, I'm going to strongly advise that you stop that. Two contradictory approaches running concurrently like this would never be advisable in any field because it's only going to result in your child being confused, and that will be counterproductive to your overall aim. So make a parental choice as to which therapist you want your child to work with and cancel the other one and stay engaged with that therapist. And my strong advice would be go with the play-based, child-centered approach.
Yeah, which one gets the impression that would be their preference
yeah.
as well, and most importantly the child's preference.
I think so, yeah. And I think he's letting them know that. Yeah.
My three-year-old has started crying over dying. She gets very upset about other people dying around her too. No one is dying around us in our family or network of friends. We don't know where this is coming from or what to do, to be honest, as nothing we say seems to help her.
Oh, I mean, that's just really tough when your child is so young. But, it's actually a fear of dying is quite common for children aged between particularly 4 and 8 years. So this little one is a little ahead of the curve on that. So helping her get through it takes a slightly different approach, because after the age of 4, children developmentally are much more capable of narrative and projective narrative based understanding of concepts. Whereas a 3-year-old might not fully grasp that, which could be why nothing you seem to do or say is helping at the moment. So I would, as always, don't sugarcoat it. I'm a fan of being honest, developmentally appropriate, but honest with children when they have questions. Between the ages of like 12 and 18 months, children begin to develop what we'd call permanence. It starts with objects and it moves on to people. I mean, that can be as simple as, you hide their teddy bear behind your back and you say, "Where's Teddy?" And then you make Teddy reappear. And through, repeated experience of that, your child eventually one day goes, "Look, I know Teddy's behind your back."
Yes.
He still exists.
And but it's great fun all the time. They don't realise.
Exactly,
and they're surprised every
because
time.
Because they're surprised, because when they don't see something, it ceases to exist, and then they get it. And once they get that with objects like a teddy, they can transfer it to people. So when you leave a room, you cease to exist, and that's terrifying initially, but you keep reappearing. And through repeated experience, I get that even when I don't see you, you still exist and I can hold you in mind. And we just call that people permanence. Developmentally, very normal, and usually happens without a hiccup. So what can happen then is, just as I've begun to internalize, God, people are forever, even when I don't see them, this concept of, oh no, people are not forever, people can die, hits children. And that's very overwhelming because they've just internalized you're forever and they have to now entertain, maybe you're not. So when they get the concept of people die, and again, it doesn't have to, it can often be triggered by a real life experience within your family or network, but it can also be gleaned from TV shows, from peers, from hearing about someone else's granny dying, from simply coming across it as a concept and they can hang on to it. Mm. So I would say approach this quite head on, but not sugar-coated, developmentally appropriate. And what I mean by that is talk to your little one about life cycles, that we have birth, we have growth, we have getting older, and we have dying. And that's part of every living creature's life cycle. And emphasize that, you know, you're young and healthy and everybody takes care of themselves so that they live a very long time. Don't, or try not to make those reassurances of mommy and daddy aren't going to die for a very long time, because while we hope that's true and on the balance of probability it's true, you can't blanket say that. I have worked with a little girl who was assured of those things by her parents, but unfortunately she did have a sudden death of one of her parents, and trust was shattered because she really did believe that. So I think talk about it in that way. With children, they're quite visual learners. I'm going to suggest you plant a seed and involve her in watching the seed grow and develop. And, you know, they don't, if they're in my house anyway, they don't live forever. Mm. And let her, you know, get exposed to this life cycle through a plant, or perhaps something like a goldfish, you know, where she can get used to that removed level, that this is quite a normal occurrence. So I think that's, you know, that's what I'd mainly be saying. There is a little book. There was a children's book series called Mog by Judith Kerr. A lot of parents will know this one. Mog is a cat, and there's, you know, many books in the series because the cat gets up to all kinds of adventures. But the final Mog book is a lovely one to start introducing. It's Goodbye Mog. It's actually very sad. You know, Mog dies and that's how the series ends. Mm. But it's dealt with beautifully. And it's dealt with in a way that children can feel the sadness but understand the concept.
Yeah.
So there's a couple of things like this. She's three. She's a little bit young, as I said, in terms of how you would typically address this, but it is something parents typically have to address, you know, certainly within the next 12 months, between the ages of 4 and 8, this is one that rears its head.
God, it's a tough one, though.
It
really
is really tough. And especially if we're uncomfortable talking about death, because we then transfer that going, oh my gosh. I often think, you know, parents dread the question of where did babies come from? But I think this one is harder.
Are you going to die?
What is death and what happens when we die? I think it's completely harder than where did babies come from? Mm. So it's something that, you know, if you are facing into that age or stage of development, maybe start knitting yourself a little narrative that you have to hand when the inevitable question comes up. It is inevitable.
Gina says, we had this issue when our dog passed away. Our 6-year-old was obsessed with where he went, why he died, why we couldn't help, what's he doing now, etc. We found just answering all the questions helped him to understand it in his own way.
Yeah, because his questions are letting you know what he needs to know.
Yeah, yeah, rather than giving them
too much information.
We are facing a battle with our 10 and 11-year-olds who want to download Fortnite, a 12 rating, I assume this is a game,
that involves
gun violence. We've never had these games before in the house. Are they harmful to their development, or are we being overcautious as they never even had toy guns?
Okay, I mean, there's a lot of me going yes, no, as you were reading through that to various parts. I mean, it's quite normal for children to play with toy guns, and toy guns, you know, don't, I mean, I've seen children make guns out of their index finger and their thumb. So
yeah, sure.
That's quite a normal way for children to play. I wouldn't worry about that. I of course, would have to flag that at 10 and 11, they are below the recommended age for this game, which is 12 rated.
Mm.
So that can be a valid reason for parents to say, actually, you're too young and I'm not, as your parent, I have a duty of care and I have to make sure you don't play things that are too old for you. And you could kick this down the road a bit. The game itself is, in my opinion, geared towards children. The developers knew what they were doing. The graphics are very cartoonish. I'm going to describe it in my way, and I'm sure people listening will have maybe the same or different views on it, but I'd call it a mass online brawl with cartoonish figures and graphics. There's no bloody violence in it, but it is an aggressive fight-based game.
Right.
Now, many studies would make links between playing violent video games and real-life aggression, increase in aggression in children with a decrease in what we'd call pro-social skills. For me, I would be flagging the duration of engagement. How long would they be spending on this game? And monitoring your children for how do they get affected? No two children are going to react in the same way. These kinds of visual video game interactions are very cognitive, virtually stimulating. And then as parents, we go in and we tend to say, you know, you've been on that long enough, let's turn it off. And then we have a meltdown behaviourally because the children are so stimulated cognitively and we're now asking them to switch into the moment, into the now. Mm. They're overwhelmed. Overstimulated means they're going to melt down. It's sensory too much. So I would think watch the time spent. If it's an Xbox or a PlayStation that you have, they definitely have parental controls that enable you to limit the length that your child is playing a game. So you could use those. And you could also just say that they can play it with you in the room, you watching and you asking a ton of annoying questions that's going to actually keep them from getting too absorbed into the game and in the moment. But I also have to say, like you're asking, is it harmful to their development? It is harmful to their development if it is taking the place of in-person practical play.
Yeah.
Because all children need in the moment person-to-person engagement for their development. They need to be outside, they need to be in nature kicking a ball, they need to be doing small world play, they need to be working out with little characters, cars and figures. Even at this age, they need to be doing arts and crafts, they need to be doing sensory-based activities. Again, they're not just nice and twee, they're developmentally important.
Mm.
So if this video game is a small part of your child's overall play experience, it's not going to do developmental harm. If it is going to take over and be predominantly how they play, then yes, it would. So I'm going to say it's a parental decision overall, yeah, but there are some factors in there to consider.
Yeah, I often wonder though, because it says download.
Yeah.
So they're getting it off. So a 12 rating, who gave it the 12 rating and what part of the world did they give it a 12 rating?
And who's reviewing it?
Yeah.
I mean, when you give something a 12 rating, it's based on a projection how this might be received and experienced. But it's only if you actually observe and review how children interact. I mean, lots of children and lots of children who I come across in the clinic really are not suited to video game play.
Yeah.
And you know, children who have a tendency to get overstimulated, who are prone to more anxiety-based responses, who are prone to impulse control issues, they are not ideal candidates for any game.
That's, you know, because it just strikes me, based on my own experience, if they're having a battle now, even if they allow it, they're going to have to accept the fact there will be more battles.
Oh, there's going
There'll
to be
a battle
battles.
Every time they turn the blinking thing off.
Absolutely. And I think as well, you know, we're facing a battle. You are the parents in charge. Your children can demand, and that's okay. They're allowed to do that. And that's part of the job of being a child, is to demand unreasonable things and demand things that they're not allowed to have. But it is our job to say, no, here's why I'm saying no, and I'm holding that boundary.
Yeah. And depending on that, just again, because some of my own kids are kind of like, you go, turn that off, and they'd ignore you, and then they'd sigh and do it. But, you know, some of them went like in psycho, and then that's when you realize this is too much, you know, and you kind of have to stop it altogether. Perhaps,
you do. And you know, I mean, it can be helpful to use something like a visual timer, you know, one of those big, I'm going to call it like an egg timer, you know, those sand hourglass things,
yeah,
but you can get them that are 10 minutes long. And if you say, you know, when all that sand hits the bottom, the game goes off, children see their time going and it's more regulating than you simply coming in and turning it off abruptly.
Yes.
Even if you've been saying 10 minutes, they'll still experience it as abruptly.
Yeah. That Fortnite is a nightmare, says the text.
Yeah,
my son,
surprised,
who is 14, loses the plot with it. I keep switching it off. Next step is deleting the bloody thing. It should be 18s in my book.
Interesting, yeah.
There you go. I remember my nephew was given Grand Theft Auto when he was 13. The game was over 18s. I was so angry with my sister for buying it because I knew how violent it was, and also that my kids would kick up a fuss. It was all he played non-stop. I don't think it did much for his social skills.
No, it definitely doesn't. I mean, there's lots of research to back that up. And Grand Theft Auto is extremely aggressive and violent and absolutely warrants the 18 cert it has. Parents really should pay attention to the certs.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. And really, kind of an 18 cert on a game isn't even equivalent to an 18 cert in a film.
No, you're talking extreme violence.
Yeah, extreme stuff. Now, you read a text saying Fortnite should be 18s. If that person believes that, then why are they continuing to let the child play? Parental responsibility? ? That woman, is my son is 14, loses the plot with it. I keep switching it off. Next step is deleting the bloody thing. It should be 18s. Well, I think that parent is edging close to that point, really. Now, I mean, it's very easy in, you know, in a vacuum to say, oh, you should just say no. And it's as simple as that. It requires a lot of energy. It's not just the act of saying no, because that no has to be repeated sometimes over a period of months. I was just telling Joanna a story about that. I have an 11-year-old son who has a major fear of food. It started when he was about 15 months old and his teeth were coming through. The teething was so bad, he would not allow me to put a spoon near his mouth, with the result he would only eat finger food, as he could do this himself. He's now in a position where he's being sent home from school due to vomiting, stomach pains and bloating. I've tried everything I can think of, and currently he's attending a herbalist who is treating him with herbs and acupuncture to build up his immune system and work on his digestive system. Do you think he needs psychological help?
Gosh, there's a lot. I mean, I think it's great that this parent can make links back to when you think this started, you know, at 15 months. And a lot of small babies, when they're teething, have food avoidance, at least for a period of time while the tooth is coming down. And if you believe there's a correlation that he is at 11 years old still making that association, I would have cause for concern there. Yeah. Particularly because at 11, you know, he's growing so quickly and needs, you know, a certain kind of nutrition. So I'm assuming that he's still not eating enough food for you, though it's not explicitly stated here because you describe it as a major fear of food. I would say, when you say you've tried everything, you don't say what you've tried. So I'm going to err on the side of maybe you haven't taken him to a pediatric dietitian. Maybe you have. If not, I would certainly do that. And I would consider, I know of a Dublin-based course that's really helpful for parents run by eatwell.ie on severe eating difficulties that would include the, you know, any conditions, anything up to that ARFID, which would be avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, where children really are, it's beyond fussy eating. I mean, children can be fussy eaters, but this is something else. Yeah. This reads to me as if it's in the something else category if it's going on 11 years
vomiting,
later.
Vomiting, stomach pains and bloating are
I'd be
serious
very concerned.
Enough as it is.
Yeah. So I think certainly refer to a pediatric dietitian. Make an inquiry. I don't know where in the country you're based, but if you're Dublin based, that's one such course. If you're not, there would be similar courses available in your area. So contact either your local health centre or a pediatric dietitian and get some direction about what courses are available for parents around supporting this. And yes, I certainly would consider a referral for child psychotherapy or a psychological assessment, because there may be an emotional charge now around food, or an association that food equals pain and discomfort. And that might be something that you do need third party help. Make all of those queries, and bear in mind you might not get appointments immediately with anyone. So in the interim, increase tactile and sensory play anyway. Like let him mess with food, play with his hands with it, like you would with a small child, so that they don't become tactile oversensitive and tactile avoidant, because that can help. There's also a little system called the teaspoon challenge that you could try. And the important thing here is you put a new food or a food you want them to try on a teaspoon. That's the sole portion. Don't put it on their plate, and don't put it touching other food, because lots of children don't like food touching other food and they won't eat anything for you then. But if you put it on a teaspoon beside the plate, and everyone gets one, not just your child, including you, and you don't pass comment, you want everyone to try it. So you try it and you simply move on. If your child's like, I'm not eating what's on that teaspoon, you just move on. Don't make a big deal out of it, including if they eat it, they don't get massive applause and massive reward. It's there as a challenge. And if you repeat that every single day with something on the teaspoon, you might land on something that he will try. And it's only a teaspoon worth.
Yes. OK. So
it's one bite. So try the teaspoon challenge, the sensory play. But I would be getting onto a dietitian and a child psychotherapist at this stage.
Yeah. Given the vomiting, stomach pains and bloating would be enough to freak out any parent.
Absolutely.
So is it not worth pointing out that assuming it's something to do with something that happened the best part of 10 years ago is a bit of a stretch, unless you have a degree in that kind of thing? And doesn't this child need immediate medical attention?
Yeah.
Not a herbalist, in other words.
Well, I think, I don't know.
This is just me talking. But,
I don't want to dismiss the herbalist either, because I don't know, you know, especially if the child and the parent believes this will help, maybe it is going to help, but it shouldn't be the sole course of action. I think a consult with your GP, a consult with a pediatric dietitian and a child mental health expert is certainly a route that I would be strongly encouraging this parent to follow at this stage, because I don't want that child getting any older, because the longer they have these food issues, the harder it actually is to deal with it. Mm-hmm. You know, like everything, early intervention is best, but this is a 10-year issue. So it's time to address it head on.
The next question is this: this is actually isn't about the child at all. It's about the parent.
I know, yeah.
But then again, not an uncommon one. My three-year-old has been with me since the day she was born and is now starting play school. It's a fab all-outdoor play school in Cork. I know it's right for her, but how will I cope? How will she cope? How can I prevent myself from standing in a nearby field with binoculars weeping? Help!
Oh, poor mama. I actually think, you know, whatever you do, do not stand in a nearby field with binoculars. You're going to invite all kinds of attention to yourself. But all joking aside, I think there's a lot of parents who can empathise with this. First of all, you haven't been away from your three-year-old in 3 years. It's time.
Yeah.
It for both of you.
Yeah.
So again, I mentioned earlier about people permanence. One of the ways that children develop security and confidence is that they build trust that when you go, you'll come back. But you actually do have to go for them to experience that. So your child is well able. You've made a good choice. This sounds like a lovely play school experience, very outdoors, very experiential. But when she starts, and this is often the case, even when children are making that transition from play school to big school, I think September is such a high call time I get professionally. Parents call and call because they're so stressed about them starting school. Will they cope? When behind that question is, will I cope?
Yeah.
So plan some activities for yourself for the first 2 weeks. That means, I don't know, book a blow dry, get your nails done, go meet a friend for coffee. You know, make activities so that you're not sitting around anxiously twiddling your thumbs and counting down the hours. Play school isn't a full day, it's a short day. Use the time, embrace the time. You haven't had it in 3 years. This is a good thing.
Yeah.
However you talk to your child about their play school experience, be super positive. Don't betray your anxiety and your doubt and your fear that neither of you will cope, because your child will absolutely pick up on that, and you don't want to compromise or taint their experience. Because, I mean, look, at the job of parenting is to teach children the art of living independently of us. That's what it is. And that's the hardest part of it, because we don't want to let go. But it's so important that we learn to let go.
And on that first day, and for perhaps weeks or even months afterwards, the three-year-old will cry. And for some period of time, at least, and will go, and you're going to feel horrible walking out the door.
Absolutely. Or they won't cry at all, and you'll feel terribly betrayed. and then, all right, see you, I'm off. And you'll be the one crying at the door.
And then after a while, you'll go to pick them up and they'll be crying when you're trying to stuff them back into the car because they don't want to leave.
And also trust the staff that you're leaving, of the play school that you're leaving your daughter with, because they've done this before. They know. They often have a system. They know how to settle children. They know how to deal with this. They often know how to settle and reassure parents too. So don't be afraid to let them know that you're struggling with this.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, she won't be alone in that at all.
I think within 2 weeks, you're going to find you're really enjoying this newfound time back to yourself.
A few comments on video games, that particularly this game Fortnite that somebody was asking about earlier on. Fiona says, it was when my son was recreating what he was doing on the video game with his sister that put the fear of God in me. He was playing a wrestling game, but he was trying to perform the actual moves from the game. Very dangerous manoeuvres too. That was enough for me to ban video games from the house, says Fiona. Dave says, I was playing Fortnite with my 12 and 10-year-old last night. We had a great time. None of us killed anybody. It's really hard, but we all helped each other. It requires some skill. Ken in Mayo says, the games are totally fine. I've no issues. The problem is that parents don't set boundaries and get out clause for their inadequate parenting, says Ken. Ken's 37, by the way, a 37-year-old gamer, but it hasn't affected him in a bad way. So that's a weight off our shoulders, Ken. Thanks for that. And Sean, 30-year-old Sean, as he describes himself, says, Jesus, after listening to your parenting expert for a while, I've learned kids are a lot of work. I'm thinking I could do without kids and be able to go on more holidays and watch more Netflix.
You're welcome, Sean. Yeah.
Those things are all objectively true. Joanna Fortune, thanks a million for coming into us.
Parenting on Moncrief. Thanks to Five Rivers Fostering, recruiting and supporting foster parents and children. Five Rivers Fostering.ie.